This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today, a show about departures. Charlotte Douglas International Airport is about to become a gateway to Cuba, with the Cold War long over. U.S. relations with this island nation have finally begun to thaw, and flights will begin from our airport to Havana later this summer. We hear about what to expect once you arrive and about our evolving relationship with this still communist country. That's later in the program. First, former Charlotte City Manager Ron Carley. He came to town more than 3 years ago and from the start seemed to be occupied with putting out fires. The city council was fractured at the time over our impending streetcar project. The mayor was caught up in an FBI sting, and the city was wrestling with Raleigh over control of the airport and later the rights of transgender people. After working with five mayors in 3 years, Ron Carley decided not to seek an extension of his contract, I wonder why, and left the city manager's job at the end of June. But we invited him to join us to share some of his experiences with us before he gets caught up in the rest of his life. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much, Mike. Good to see you. To see you.
You came here from Arlington, Virginia, which is near where I grew up, and you'd been the county manager of that D.C. suburban area for a while, and later on the COO of the International City County Managers Association. As I understand it, you weren't looking to get back into the city manager job field. But you said it was this job was, when it came open, was just too interesting to pass up. Why?
Well, Charlotte's a great city. Mind you,
how did you know that?
Well, actually, I'd never been here.
Right.
But my geography, my wife and I, is basically North Carolina and Virginia. It's an area that we like. How many really real cities are there between Washington and Atlanta?
None.
One.
Well, that's what I say, one.
and that's Charlotte. And so we came here mostly on Charlotte's reputation to go through the interview. Spent a lot of time in the city talking to people everywhere we went. And universally, people that we talked to when we came for our first visit and came for the interview said they really love Charlotte. And most of them were not Charlottians. They were not from here. They'd come from literally all over the country. And what we saw is a city that people choose to live in, what I refer to as a place of intent. Mm-hmm. You're not here just because you end up here. You end up here and stay here because you really like the city. And it was very impressive to us. I think the quality of life here is second to none.
You're like me, as I read through your resume, in that you found a job that you liked and you stayed in it for a very long time. That's the Arlington County manager job, and had no real intention of leaving that either, as I understand it. When you came here, did you have a time horizon? Did you say, I'm going to be here for 3 years, I'm going to be here for 6 years, I'm going to be here for 10 years?
Well, I was very fortunate in Arlington. I was there 6 months shy of 30 years, but I was only manager the last nine of it. I had a lot of different jobs in Arlington over my career there. I'm going into jobs with an intent to be there as long as it's fun and I'm being productive. And I've never gone into a job with a fixed time limit in terms of how long I would be there. And I felt like at the end of the 3 years here that I'd accomplished what the mayor and council had hired me to do, the original mayor and council. Seven members of the council that hired me and the mayor were not here when I left.
Right.
It's a lot of change, but I felt like I'd accomplished.
Who was the mayor that hired you?
Anthony Fox.
Okay.
Who left me a really nice message on my last day. So I enjoyed working with all of the mayors and councils that I worked with, but I thought I'd accomplished what I needed to accomplish. It's a very intense 24/7 job, and I've always had the plan to go into university setting where I can help teach the next generation of local government leaders, where I can provide support for people working in the field, and do research, try to take what I've learned all across all these 40 years in local government and try to apply that to help advance the profession.
I read, and you never know if what you read is all absolutely true, but I read that you had this epiphany that it was that you'd done everything that you wanted to do in bed on a Sunday night when they announced the federal funding for the streetcar was going to happen.
Yeah, that's actually true.
Okay.
I didn't think Congress was going to adopt a budget, and I thought it was going to drag out and that we would not be able to get the federal funding for the streetcar. I was not particularly optimistic. We'd done everything we were supposed to do, and the president had included it in his budget. And I was lying there, and I think, whoa, they really adopted it, and it's really done.
Hmm.
That was the mess I inherited. The year before I came, the council was unable to adopt an update to the capital improvement program. The city missed an entire bond cycle when capital costs were the lowest they probably ever would have been. And the council is very fractured, and I was hired to put that back together, and I did.
Anthony Fox was the mayor. He was a proponent of the streetcar. He's now the Secretary of Transportation, so that seems to be in his wheelhouse. No pun intended there. You had experience in Arlington with streetcars. You are also a proponent of streetcars, and there's still a split opinion on the streetcar that we have, this 1.5 mile line that we have.
Yeah, it's really not about streetcar per se. It's about what kind of infrastructure do you need to have in a city in order to attract the talent that you want and to provide the kind of lifestyles and amenities that people want today. If you want to be a city that attracts and keeps young people, if you want to have a vibrant downtown that is alive and with the kind of restaurants and shows and events that people are looking to today, then you've got to have public transportation that works. The new generation of young people are much smarter than us.
But why?
They don't want to waste their money on cars. They want to spend their money on drinking and going to shows and eating and having fun.
But the argument here, well, of course, it's the same argument that was put forth when they were trying to build out the Blue Line, that people don't want to be in a train. They want to they want the freedom of their automobile, and they want to be able to use the roads that we've paid for and not ride a car.
And that's just actually not true for the current generation.
Okay. So now they're saying, with regard to the streetcar, well, we understand the Blue Line. That makes sense. But streetcar is a 1910 technology, 1890s technology. Why are we bringing something like that back?
Yeah, because it actually worked then. And if we hadn't gotten sucked into the internal combustion engine, we wouldn't have the air pollution and the sprawl that we have in the world today.
Yeah, the forces at work in the early 20th century were the automobile companies who kind of pushed
Right. And it was all about making money and profit. And I think we're getting more focused in our cities today about quality of life. Mm-hmm. And quality of life is about being able to get around, not owning a car. And the difference between with the streetcar and with light rail is that once you put rail in the streets, you know where that vehicle is going. That's the difference between a streetcar and a bus. You get on a bus, you never know where it's going to go. You think you do, if you can figure out the routing system. And apparently only low-income people that really depend on buses can figure out the routing system. Right. Wealthier people seem to not be able to figure it out.
They don't want to. They don't want to bother with it.
That's right. But we have people in this city that absolutely depend on mass transit to be able to get to jobs and doing the work that makes the city run. When you put rail in the streets, though, people know where that car is going, and your ridership universally goes up. And in Charlotte, most importantly, this is infrastructure that can bring prosperity and opportunity to East and West Charlotte.
Can you empirically prove that?
Well, I think if you look at what has happened in other cities where investments have been made in rail, it becomes very clear. If you look at what's happened with the Blue Line, again, the Blue Line, the difference between light rail and streetcar is one runs in dedicated right-of-way and the other one runs in the street. Mm-hmm. And the new cars for Phase 2, the streetcar, will be modern cars that look like the light rail system.
Right. Why do you suppose there's still people who are naysayers on this project? Because people like you have preached this for years. We've seen the success of the Blue Line. Ridership projections have been exceeded on the streetcar. Of course, it is free. Why do you suppose there are still naysayers? And do you think when they start charging, and they will, for the streetcar, that people will continue to ride it in the numbers they're riding it today?
Well, yes, they will continue to ride it, just as people are going to use the tow lanes on I-77 once it opens. I mean, there are naysayers on everything. And so, you know, that's part of the challenge of being a city manager and what takes its toll. In a city this size and this complex, you've got conflicting opinions on anything that you want to do. And there's always going to be controversy. If you're trying to move forward, if you're about advancing, if you're about growing, if you're about progress, you're going to have to be able to put up with some opposition and naysayers.
We're talking to Ron Carley. He's the former Charlotte city manager. He left that job on the 1st of July, so he's had 20 days of freedom to think about life. You were the first person from outside Charlotte to be hired for this job since 1981. I'm sure you knew that coming in. Did that make the job more difficult, or did you find it easy to come in and shake things up as an outsider?
Right. Well, first of all, I would say that Charlotte is one of the most welcoming cities anywhere. So many people have come to Charlotte from the outside. There is a culture here that people are accepted. You don't have to track your lineage back to colonial days to be accepted in the city. I think that's one of the great assets that the city of Charlotte has. I would say coming in as a senior executive in a large bureaucracy like city government from the outside definitely is a challenge. There, some of the culture is deeply ingrained, and I am at heart a change agent. And some people see that as being dismissive of the past. It's not. It's really not about not judging the past, but looking to the future. And what do we have to do to be prepared for what is next? And so it is a challenge, and I think that's true for all city managers that come in from the outside.
Why are you a change agent? What is it about you that makes you?
Right, you're either going forward or you're going backwards. And I think you've got to look objectively and analytically at what you're doing and how you're doing it. And you've got to be willing to ask questions and not accept that what we've done in the past is going to take us to where we want to be in the future. One of the great, I would say one of the great issues that's lingering in our society today, and it's definitely true in Charlotte, is our whole failure to really fully address the issue of racism and implicit bias and white privilege in our society. That's a very different conversation to have. But it's one that cities are going to have if we're going to get beyond the kind of violence and antagonism that we're seeing in a lot of cities today.
We had just had a conversation last week with Chief Kerr Putney with CMPD. He's having those conversations, and he talked about implicit bias and racism within the police department. Are we having those conversations now?
It's starting, and I'll give a lot of credit to Chief Rodney Moreau. He really pushed that issue. And I was very pleased while I was manager to actually have a thoughtful conversation about implicit bias with the executive team. And, in fact, in the city council retreat this past January, they've devoted some of their work session to talk about implicit bias as well. So this city is beginning to try to have that conversation. And if we can do that in Charlotte, it really will distinguish us among other large cities in this country.
When you were brought in, and we talked about this, I think, when we had your entrance interview on this program as opposed to today, you were brought in to be the face of Charlotte, to be the spokesperson for city government, that's because that's what the mayor at the time wanted, that's what the council at the time wanted. I think that may have changed over several mayors and several councils. How did you feel about this? Because there was certainly a shift.
Well, there was, but I've been in this business a long time, and I know a lot about the profession, and what the role the city manager plays really depends on the culture of the mayor and the city council. And some mayors and councils want you to be very public. It was very important that I play that role when I first came here. Our airport was at imminent risk, and there were a lot of people in our community who were thinking, well, it's okay, what's wrong with the commission? Other people have them, not recognizing that we're at risk of creating a cesspool of political patronage. And it was important for me to get out there on the airport. But as the council and mayors changed, they wanted someone that was more in the background. And if you've got a mayor who's willing to step out there and be the spokesperson for the city, I actually think that's a better situation to be in.
Really?
Yeah.
So it was not difficult for you to shift gears and slide
That's a dynamic that exists between every city manager and every mayor and council, and it changes as elections change.
How difficult is it? Because you're the expert here. You're the guy with the PhD. You're the guy with all this experience under your belt, running cities and counties and working with city managers and county managers across the country in your previous position. When we come back from the break, I want to ask you how difficult that is, not just for you, but for anybody in your position, to take a back seat and to carry through decisions that they think or maybe even know are not the right way to go, that have been made by politicians. We'll come back and get an answer to that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring iced tea for summer, freshly steeped and available all day, every day at area Bojangles. Donald Trump rode the down escalator at Trump Tower a year ago to announce his candidacy for president, but ever since, his journey to the GOP convention has been on the up escalator. That convention has been notable for who is not in attendance, including ex-presidents and other Republican luminaries. And we're going to get some expert takes on what's been happening in Cleveland and hear from a local delegate still undecided about the party's nominee. We'll get together and do that on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, speakers at the Republican National Convention address jobs and the economy. A convention update, analysis of Donald Trump's economic plans, and how his own successes and failures as a businessman could shape voter opinion.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Ron Carley, who was for 3 years or more the city manager of Charlotte, came here from Arlington, Virginia, decided to leave on July 1st. This is the exit interview. So
the departure. Remember, this show's about departures today.
That's right, it is. So what is it like to be the expert and have to carry out the orders of people who have been elected by the populace to make decisions on their behalf, even if those decisions you think are misguided or wrong?
Well, if they're not ethical and violate your values, you need to leave the organization. You shouldn't be there. And I never confronted that in Charlotte. To the contrary, I found the mayor and councils that I worked with, public policy values were very much aligned with mine. I was very proud to be associated with them, particularly on things like the non-discrimination ordinance civil liberties ordinance. This council, I think, really, and all the councils I've worked with here, really stand for the right thing. But you have to be, for a city manager, you have to respect democracy. You have to respect that people are elected in our form of government and be prepared to work with them. There have been times when I've gone home really frustrated and ranting and raving and said, I just can't take this anymore. You can't believe what the council did today. And my wife would say, what you said a minute ago. She said, now, Ron, you're the one with a doctorate in public administration. You're the one that has studied this all your life. They haven't, and it's your job to go and help them understand what their job is and to do what they need to do to accomplish what they were elected to be.
Were you able to do that?
Well, I think so. I'm very proud of what we accomplished in the 3 years here, and I think we have council members who want to do the right thing and are open to learning and growing as elected officials.
And you, prior to this job, you were the COO of the International City County Managers Association, so you've talked to them all over the country, and you say this frustration, this why did they do that? Or look, do you see what they've done now? Is a conversation that happens with every city or county manager.
Oh, absolutely. I was at a conference with other North Carolina managers just a couple of weeks ago, and some of them are just going through some horrific things with council. Where it really is of greatest challenge to city managers is when there's rancor and dissension on the council, when they are fighting with each other and not supporting each other. And we've had some of that in Charlotte. I think it's really important that the council, whether they agree with the mayor or not, that they support the mayor. I think the mayor needs to respect and support the council, and council members really need to support each other and recognize that we're ultimately in this together. We're going to have differing perspectives in a democracy. You don't have 11 council members because you want them all to think the same. You don't elect from 7 different districts because you want everybody with the same value set. You want to have some creative and dynamic discussion and even tension. But at the end of the day, you want to come together and do what's right for the city.
You have talked this morning already about maybe going back to academia. You have been an adjunct professor at George Washington University for years now, even when you were in Arlington, right, Virginia. And as an intelligent person, people learn from their experience and they learn from their mistakes. Can you think of and you've talked about wanting to go back and take what you've learned here and use it in the classroom. Can you think of instances where you really pushed for something, the council decided not to go in your direction, and they were right?
In Charlotte? No, I really can't think of an example where I tried to push them in a direction that they truly did not want to go. Mm-hmm. Again, the most controversial issue was around the streetcar. But there were strong majority votes for the streetcar every time it came before the council when I was here. Again, right, we had to redirect the plan and come up with a different funding mechanism. From a public policy standpoint, there was nothing that I saw that really needed to be done in Charlotte that I had a resistant council. All the budgets were very good budget process. You know, even this last year, I recommended a tax increase, and they decided to increase trash fees instead.
Right.
The amounts of money were on the margin, and it's a legitimate policy difference. I still think the tax rate was the right thing to do, but doing the trash increase, was that the wrong thing? No, it's a legitimate policy decision they decided to go with.
In writing about your tenure as Charlotte City Manager, the Charlotte Business Journal described it as one of managing near constant crises and controversy. Is that how you viewed it?
Yeah, pretty much. the most disheartening thing, and it's important for me to remain positive, and you know, I think you can see that that's very much my orientation, really has been the General Assembly. And the reality is the mayor and council do not want to fight with the General Assembly. And I've heard this sort of paranoia from General Assembly members that they think the council does things just to create political dynamic that undercuts them, the General Assembly members. There's a real paranoia there. When in fact, the city has never wanted to be in conflict with our elected officials in Raleigh.
I'm sure you're talking here about HB2 and not the airport, but
well, take your pick. It's on registration of rental property. It's on billboards. It's on taxis. You know, everything that we do in local government is subject to the whim of sometimes one person in Raleigh who has a friend that wants to do something different.
Do you find it odd that much of this these maneuvers in Raleigh are coming from the Mecklenburg County delegation?
Well, that's disappointing because there's no – Charlotte and Mecklenburg elected officials should very much be on the same page and working for the same things. And a conflict between our locally elected officials and our folks that go to Raleigh, it hurts the area in ways that people don't fully appreciate.
Can you be on the same page in Raleigh when the bulk of the delegation and the entire legislature is Republican and the city council and city of Charlotte is primarily Democratic? Can you, in this political environment, can you even get together?
Well, that's the key, is this political environment where things become so entrenched, R&D, and local issues are not Republican-Democratic issues. The meat and potatoes things that it takes to really run a city should be nonpartisan and are not about larger macro philosophical things.
What was the power grab or the attempted power grab over the airport about in your mind? What was that about?
Yeah, there's a really good question. I think a lot of it was just trying to undermine Anthony Fox and the council at the time.
Why?
I think people in the General Assembly get rabidly angry when you say this, but I think some of it was racially motivated. Now, they will vehemently deny that and will be very incensed that I said it. And I've been in meetings where it was actually discussed openly, and they say that is not true. I think there's a significant race overlay on the conflicts between the representation of our council and the representation of Raleigh.
As some of the things that have been said about Republican reaction to Barack Obama's presidency. Same thing.
I don't think it can be denied.
Wow.
Race still plays a really pervasive role in our society. You know, we as white people keep wanting to think that we're beyond that, and we're not. And now with the pervasive nature of social media and being able to actually see what some police officers are doing to some African Americans, we've got a much different conversation going on now. And we can make some real advancement if people don't do crazy things. And the assassination of police officers now in two cities is the number one thing that will most undermine our ability to have an honest conversation on race. And those assassinations are heartbreaking on so many levels and create a really significant barrier to us really coming to grips with racial equity in this country.
So the FAA recently ruled in a way that makes it practically impossible for the airport to be taken away from the city of Charlotte, which has operated it since its inception. Is this over now? Is the airport issue over and done with?
Well, it should be. Brent Cagle has done an extraordinary job as aviation director. He's taken what was an extraordinary creation by Jerry Orr, probably the only person who could have created Charlotte Douglas International Airport. And Brent and his team have taken it to a new higher level of professionalism that is necessary to sustain an airport of this size and complexity into the long term. And I don't think you'll find a better functioning airport anywhere in America. And we should, from a policy, political standpoint, from the outside, leave it alone and let it work.
The legislature also removed from Charlotte and other municipalities around the state business tax revenues during your tenure as city manager. In Charlotte, that amounted to about $18 million every year and left you navigating a budget gap of about $22 million. Has the city recovered, and do you understand why the legislature would remove revenue, that sizable amount of revenue, without replacing it with something else?
Well, I think this is where some of the Republican philosophy emerges, where they do believe in less government. And what the practical consequence is, it really limits the revenues that are available and the diversification of revenues that are available. And the practical reality is it's going to result in higher property taxes in all urban areas in this state and not provide cities with the kind of diversity and balance of revenues that they really need to be successful. I think it really undermines the future of cities in North Carolina.
Why? Why would they be working against the economic engines of the state?
Again, they have a real commitment to lowering taxes on businesses, which is what this has done. And that is part of the base that they are subscribing to. And pushing everything into sales tax, which has
so business. It's regressive. Sales tax is regressive.
So
it's business over individuals. It's
absolutely
business over taxpayers.
Absolutely.
Business over voters.
Absolutely.
Why is that?
Is
that a favorable message to people?
Well, I don't think it is a favorable message, and I think in the long run, it won't survive. But we're going to have a lot more conversation to help people understand. It's sort of like the airport. People didn't understand the impacts of taking away from the city and giving it to a commission. We've got to have much more, much broader and more intelligent conversations about taxes and tax policies and diversification of revenues.
You also presided over the recent dust-up between the city and the legislature over HB2. Some blame Charlotte and Mayor Jennifer Roberts for opening a can of worms that did not need to be opened, they say. How do you view this? I know that you're very much in favor of what Charlotte City Council did at the ordinance level.
Well, I'm very much in favor of cities being non-discriminatory. I don't think there's any argument on the other side of that. If you're going to be a great city, and the greatest cities are, it's very clear from the research, are cities that are welcoming and opening to all people. And Charlotte's action was to make a statement in terms of who you want to be as a global city, and that whoever you are, you'll be accepted. And our businesses have already done that. Their non-discrimination hiring policies, they know that they have to be non-discriminatory. And I think a very radical group of people on the Christian right hijacked the issue and resulted in some really, really bad policy in Raleigh. Now, what's ironic, if what they really cared was about bathrooms, they could have passed a one-sentence bill that said local governments are preempted from regulating private bathrooms and called it a day. But in the first version of it, they tried to basically undo all the civil rights legislation in the state.
You said the General Assembly did not use good judgment in the path they took, and it's hurt Charlotte, and it's hurt all of North Carolina. Some businesses have come out against this. Many big businesses have come out against this, but nothing really. There hasn't been any dramatic fallout yet. What should the NBA do in your mind? Should they pull the All-Star Weekend?
No, I think the absolute wrong thing to do, if you believe in non-discrimination and you believe in equity, is to come to Charlotte and to come and stand with Charlotte and support Charlotte in what it did. The NBA wants to have an event where all people are welcome, and I don't think there's any city in America where people will be more welcome than they are in Charlotte. Charlotte stood up and did the right thing, and we need the NBA and we need performers to come to this city and to articulate their support for the policies that Charlotte believes in. I think that's the best way to combat HB2. Boycotting cities that do the right thing is absolutely the wrong approach.
I want to go back to something that you talked about earlier with regard to racism, implied and implicit racism. And Todd on Twitter writes, how can we address racism and inherent bias through city management? How can you do that?
Well, having the conversations within the city organization itself and helping our own city workers to understand what they don't know about race and white privilege. And again, I will give Chief Monroe and people in our juvenile courts in particular real credit for bringing forward programs on implied bias that we're running a lot of people through, both city and county people and police, to create a greater awareness about what the real history of this country is and how deeply embedded disparity and racism still is. I mean, for people like us, Mike, we don't think of white privilege because it's just what it is. It's the way we've lived. We've never seen it on the other side.
Yeah.
Until we can step out of our shoes and look at what other people are dealing with in their efforts to achieve opportunity and equity, we won't be able to get anywhere.
You're a white guy. Why do you understand that?
Because I've had the privilege of working with very diverse populations over my career. And I've had people, particularly I remember a guy named Jay Bell back in the 1980s, African-American male who was about my father's age, who had been in the Peace Corps, retired from the federal government. He essentially mentored me on these issues. And he told me, he said, Ron, if you care about equity and you want to be an executive in a diverse organization and you want it to be diverse, you have to be willing as a white person to talk about race.
You've also, because you've talked about this in other interviews, you've also had one-on-one experiences, interactions with life imprinting experiences with gay people.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of your teachers in high school was...
My high school English teacher probably had one of the most profound influences of me on anyone I ever knew. And he was an early victim of AIDS. I never knew he was gay. In fact, I didn't even know what gay was back then. But we had a very close relationship. And my parents were divorced. I didn't have a male figure in my life. Mm-hmm. And Paul Caudill really helped me get through high school and get into college and be the person that I am today. And I never got a chance to know who he truly was and to tell him that it was okay. He lived his life in the closet, and I don't think people should have to do that.
And with a transgendered individual in county government elsewhere, you've had...
I had one of my senior executives come to me, and he was very nervous and anxious, and she said, Ron, you know, I just want to share with you, I hope you can understand this, that I'm not the man that I've been pretending to be. And I've wrestled with it for years, and I've made the decision to go through the treatments and the surgery to become the woman that I really am. And I'd worked with this guy really close, and he was an outstanding professional, and that he was so fearful and anxious to be able to come out and to be his true self, you know, it still pains me. And the transgender population has been extraordinarily marginalized in our society. And the good thing about HB2 is this. We've had more education and discussion about transgender issues in the past 60 days than we've had in the past 60 years. And I am hopeful that we will get to a new place of fairness and equity in this society.
We have less than a minute left. What are you planning to do now that you're not doing what you did?
Well, I am taking off the rest of the summer and trying to figure that out. I'm having conversations with a number of universities to find the right place where I can, again, help educate the next generation of local government leaders, to help people working in the field today, particularly around civic engagement, working directly with communities and community organizations, and advocate for these values that we've talked about today.
In 10 seconds, any words of advice for your successor, whoever it may be?
Network, network, network. This is a city that is all about getting to know people, and the strength of this city is how closely networked the various institutions are.
Ron Carley, the former city manager of Charlotte. Well, come back anytime.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Mike.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Community Blood Center of the Carolinas. Blood donations historically decrease in the summer. Local businesses, churches, and organizations can host community blood drives to support local patients. CBCC.us. Speakers at the Republican National Convention talk about jobs and the economy. We'll get a convention update and analysis of Donald Trump's economic plans and how his own successes and failures as a business person could shape voter opinion. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking about Cuba when we come back. and flights about to begin from Charlotte Douglas International Airport to Cuba, and we'll hear from someone with family ties to that country who recently went back home. She'll tell us what to expect if you decide to go there. That's all upcoming, so stick around.
This week, Republicans will convene in Cleveland to nominate Donald Trump for president. NPR and PBS NewsHour will be there, too. We're teaming up to bring you live coverage each night. I'm Rachel Martin. Join me, Judy Woodruff, and Gwen Ifill for speeches, interviews, and analysis live from the Republican National Convention. Special coverage from PBS NewsHour and NPR News.
Tune in nightly beginning at 7 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHA. I'm Mike Collins. Since Fidel Castro took over the reins of power in communist Cuba, Americans have been forbidden to travel there. This travel ban continued years after the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, but a policy change in Washington has now removed that ban, and Charlotte is about to become a gateway to a land where time seems to have stopped in the 1950s. Direct flights to Havana will soon begin from Charlotte's Douglas International Airport. We're one of 10 cities selected by the government for nonstop service to Cuba, and if all is worked out, those flights should begin in late summer. One Charlotte Observer reporter has already been to Cuba, and we invited Christina Bowling, who is a style and fashion reporter there, to give us a little preview of what to expect if you decide to go. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Nice to meet you. Also with us by phone on his vacation is Dr. Gregory Weeks, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at UNC Charlotte, to help us understand the evolving relationship between the U.S. and Cuba, because Latin America is one of his areas of expertise. Thanks for being with us on your vacation, Greg.
No, thank you. My pleasure.
Charlotte's one of 10 cities selected by the U.S. Department of Transportation to receive this nonstop route to Havana. Is that because Douglas Airport is a hub, because it's one of the busiest airports in the country, because former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox is Secretary of Transportation? Why? Why are we getting this flight? Because Atlanta's getting one, too. Anybody know the answer to that question?
Well, I think that the Department of Transportation made that decision based largely on the fact that Charlotte is a hub and the size, because the intent was to establish ties that would be easiest for passengers to make the trip. So I don't know if former Mayor Fox might have had a little hand in that, but Charlotte is a hub on its own.
Okay. To many, this opening of the lines of communication and taking the travel ban down and doing some of the other things that the policy changes at the Obama administration level are doing is a no-brainer, because we've had this in effect, this embargo and this travel ban in effect since the 1960s, even as relationships with other communist nations became very open and the Berlin Wall fell. It was clear that our policy was not working. It didn't have the impact that it was intended to have. But there is still a lot of, or at least initially when this was announced, a lot of resistance to this. Why? Why is this such a political hot potato, Dr. Weeks?
Well, I mean, that just goes back to the to the Cold War, the ideology of it. So that you had a lot of Cubans, of course, coming to the United States, and many, of course, settling in Florida, but other parts of the United States. And they became the core of an anti-Castro, pro-embargo bloc. And it's just taken many, many years and generational change for that bloc to weaken. And then what we're really seeing now is the Republican Party as a whole moving more and more toward opening to Cuba and allowing free travel to Cuba.
Although Marco Rubio, one of the leading candidates for president in the Republican side of things, was very much against this, and he's from Florida, and South Florida is a center of Cuban emigration, particularly in the 1960s when people were kicked out of Cuba or had to leave Cuba very quickly. Christina Bowling, your family has ties that go way back in Cuba. Some of your relatives still live there. Your grandfather, I'm told, was a developer in Cuba prior to the Castro regime, and his property that was confiscated in today's dollars is worth about $1 billion.
That's right.
With a B. How does your family feel about this?
Well, even in my family, I mean, you find this in families of exiles, that there are many different, I have family members who can't wait to go back and would develop there if they could, and many who just wouldn't want to give the Cuban government one more cent and won't even visit while the Castro regime is still in power. Sure. So to take the story back, my mom was born in Cuba. So she and my aunt came out in 1961 as children. If some people refer to it as Operation Peter Pan, it was when Cuban parents put their children on jetliners and sent them unaccompanied to the United States. You know, as the Castros were taking power, it was just, you know, they could see that the country was rapidly devolving. Schools were being closed. You know, my grandfather was the vice president of a bank, very successful bank, and he, you know, lots of his friends actually died at the hands of the Castros just because they opposed the takeover of this regime. So, you know, as things were spiraling downwards, my mom and my aunt were sent to the United States to a girls' all-girls Catholic boarding school in Philadelphia, where they stayed for 5 years unaccompanied until my grandparents could get out of the country. So their story is not unlike, you know, thousands of other kids' stories.
So when they heard that President Obama wants to open the doors to travel and soften relationships with Raul Castro now, what was their reaction? Were they angry about it? Were they grateful for it? How do they feel?
I think apprehension would probably be the best word. The idea that a sudden flood of Americans and American dollars is going to bring any kind of sort of democracy or help to the actual people in Cuba is, a lot of people would say that that's, they're not very optimistic for
that
happening.
Are those fears well-founded? The other countries have allowed travel and travel to and trade with Cuba for years. Canadians vacation in Cuba. There are,
yes,
are luxury,
yes,
hotels there for Canadians.
Yes, and Europeans as well.
So that money is still flowing in.
It is still flowing in. But imagine, think about how close the United States is to Cuba, and think about how many people who now are going to, you know, Bahamas or any of the Saints, and think about how they are going to want to vacation in Cuba. It's been a forbidden fruit. I mean, I think that when travel starts, and should things improve there, it's not super easy to travel in Cuba today. It's not like going to the Ritz-Carlton in St. Thomas.
And we'll talk about that, because you just got back from there, mm-hmm, and it was a kind of an eye-opening and, I'm sure, poignant experience for you and your family. Dr. Weeks, what has been the impact of the embargo and the travel ban in the United States on Cuba when other countries didn't have similar bans?
Well, I mean, as far as Americans were concerned, it did make Cuba that forbidden fruit, and so it has generated a lot of pent-up demand for people who want to go to Cuba, who want to get Cuban cigars. Cuban cigars wouldn't be quite so exotic if they weren't illegal. And so I think, interestingly, a lot of the discussion in the U.S., say from the Republican Party, is not just that, oh, we need to go to Cuba to open up human rights, but rather that why is the United States government telling Americans where they can and cannot travel? Mm. And that sort of creates this artificial interest in Cuba that if people were free to go would really evaporate.
Here's another question. When this was first announced, all the television networks went to Cuba and did their evening newscast from there, and they all made a big deal out of it. And you even write about it in an article you wrote for The Observer about how it's stuck in the 50s. Everybody drives a 1950s Oldsmobile, Buick, Chevrolet, Ford, whatever it may be, but they're all from the 1950s. Trade has been going on with other countries who manufacture automobiles for years. Why are they still driving 1950s American cars, Dr. Weeks? Why aren't they driving a 2016 Mazda?
Because they can't afford it. You know, is that the economy is controlled. It's very, very slowly and haltingly moving in a capitalist direction. But it's simply that you have people with a very small amount of money. They can't earn money privately to build up, you know, large savings to buy a car, and all of the licensing required is just overwhelming. So people are stuck with sort of famously jury-rigging cars that already were in the country.
Mike, imagine that the average Cuban salary, and this is for 90% of the people, is between $25 and $45 a month.
What do things cost? Aside from cars.
Okay.
What
I mean,
does food cost?
Sure.
What does clothing cost?
Of course, it's way cheaper than we would have here, but there is not much left at the end of the day. And so if those who are lucky enough to have a car, some of them do have beat up cars from maybe Russian cars from the 80s, but we're talking about it's kind of a joke in Cuba. You ask how many different car parts are in any given car, and they'll tell you 80, 100 different pieces cobbled together from you know, scraps of what other people didn't need.
Given that, and given although they do a great job with education evidently, and they do a terrific job with medicine because they export doctors
to Venezuela,
and
right.
They have done a great job with in other fields. Music is one of them. Why has the military put up with these conditions since the 1960s? They're not living in a vacuum. They see what's going on in the rest of the world.
Well, I would argue that they are a little bit living in a vacuum. When you go to Cuba, you realize very quickly there is no free exchange of ideas. All of the media is controlled by the Cuban government. You turn on the TV, you have 5 channels, all controlled by the government. They are hot and hungry for news and exchange with the outside world. Getting on the internet is almost impossible for the average Cuban. We have money. We go down there with our devices that are maybe an unlocked cell phone or whatever. We spend $1 a minute hoping to get a little signal on a hotel Wi-Fi. It is actually a locked down country, and they're, like I said, especially the young people, they are hungry for news and exchange with the outside world. They know that there's a whole big world out there, and they know that, you know, most of them know that the conditions out here are better and the economic situation is better than what they're facing, but it is a world that is locked into itself.
When you arrived, you'd never been there before, correct?
Correct.
What were your first impressions? What hit you in the face when you got off the airplane?
I guess, well, first thing, you can't not marvel at the car, the things that everybody says, the cars, the architecture that is frozen and mid-century modern is the most modern that it gets in Cuba, the crumbling Art Deco. And then also just the fact that, you know, you land at Charlotte Douglas and you get off of the property and you see the billboards for hospital systems and Bojangles Chicken. And there you get off the airport property and you see billboards for the Cuban government. The fact that everything there is government controlled. You go to a restaurant, it's probably owned by the government. Your taxi driver, he probably is driving you on behalf of the government. So just the fact that there is moving from what we're used to, a capitalist society, into a society that is a locked-down communist country hits you in the face very, very fast.
Mm. And from your family's point of view, because you still have relatives who live there, what did they tell you about the lives they've lived since the 1960s?
Very interesting. So like you had said before, I mean, the Cuban population is a very highly educated population. Everybody has to go to school, and they are highly trained in fields. I mean, our family members range from veterinarians to engineers who are not working in their trade. A lot of them end up working in hotels or other service industries where they will interact with Canadian and European tourists for tips. So, I mean, gosh, one of our relatives is a very highly trained veterinarian, and he's not doing anything with animals because his family's quality of life is way better working in a hotel.
Explain to me, Dr. Weeks, why, if the military and the people have not risen up against this ridiculous, for lack of a better word, oppression, but it's not even oppression. We're talking about just ignoring the facts of life in Cuba. Why haven't the Castros seen that their experiment didn't work and that they could make life better if they changed something?
Well, I think that they would argue, if you want to take devil's advocate, that that their system is working. So they would say,
how can they say that? They certainly know what's going on in the outside world.
Well, I'm saying what they would argue, not I can't tell you what they believe deep in their hearts, which probably is, okay, we need to stay in power. Rather than be overthrown and killed. But the, you know, from the ideological part is that, well, we don't have homeless people. We have better health care and access than the United States. So for them, they'll say, we have democracy in Cuba because not everybody has a lot, but nobody has absolutely nothing. Now, that's the ideological part. Whether or not they see it as a complete failure can at least be glimpsed a bit by the fact that Raul Castro is saying to save socialism, we need to inject a little capitalism into the system, as much an oxymoron as that seems. But I think that's that would be their argument. Hmm.
You went back to Cuba, or you went to Cuba with people who had lived there. Would your mother go with you?
That's right. I went with my mother and my aunt and my cousin.
And you visited some of the places where they grew up. I think your grandfather's house is now an apartment building, and you ate in the dining room because the dining room of that house, your family was fairly wealthy, is now a restaurant.
That's right.
What was their reaction to go home and see that?
Oh, it was extremely bittersweet. I mean, first of all, to be able to go back, and for anybody to go back to their grandparents' house where their mother was raised and have a meal is amazing. The story of that building is very sad. I mean, it basically, you know, my mother's family was forced to leave. They came to the States. That building became an apartment building for four or five families at one point. The fascinating part about that building is that what happened was there was a Cuban man who worked in a restaurant in Cuba, married a Spaniard, went to Spain with her, built up a tremendous amount of wealth in Spain because he worked in the restaurant industry there. Divorced his wife, came back to Cuba with the money that he had made in Spain and opened a restaurant. Private citizens are allowed, if they have the capital, to open restaurants on a case-by-case basis. Open a restaurant in the home where my mother grew up. And we met him. He's been featured in the Washington Post. I mean, he really is an interesting example of how if he had not left Cuba and come back, he would have never been able to have this business.
We only have seconds left, but you say that if you go to Cuba, you should go before things begin to change. And I think you're confident that things will change. So if you go, you have some rules or some suggestions about what you should and shouldn't do, like carry cash.
Right. Well, first of all, caveat, don't go to Cuba before it all opens up unless you're an adventure traveler. Do not go expecting the Ritz-Carlton. But yes, there are a few things you need to educate yourself. There, ATM and credit cards in the United States are worth nothing there. You go with cash. You project how much you're going to need and you bring that with you. Once you're there, that's all you've got. Also, you have to plan really far ahead because there are not enough hotel rooms, especially in Havana. You will not be able to just show up and find a place to stay. If you want the whole experience, go with a Cuban-owned home called a Casa Particular.
And you'll stay on the roof, most likely.
And you may stay on the roof.
Because that's where they build guest rooms. And you say be generous, because these people make no money.
Be generous. Have an open heart. Talk to people. And if you have some extra change in your pocket, give it to your hardworking attendant wherever you may see him or her.
Christina Bowling, who has family in Cuba, fashion and style reporter for The Observer, who recently went there. I'm sure you can go on charlotteobserver.com and read all about it. And Dr. Gregory Weeks, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at UNC Charlotte.